afternoon. We have with us today Lincoln High School students from Wisconsin Rapids. Would you please stand so we can greet you? We hope you had an uneventful trip here, and we'll have an uneventful trip home. You may be seated. The Lincoln High School class is with us this afternoon as part of our Court with Class program. It's a program that the court sponsors along with the State Bar of Wisconsin. And we're pleased to say that it has won 2 national awards and is being duplicated across the country. You all have received, or should receive, a synopsis of the case we're about to hear today. If you don't have it, there are some extra copies in the ante room. And you have met with me or with Justice Bradley during the lunch hour. Now that we've met you, I would like to introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Next to him is Justice John Wilcox. To the left of him and to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage, and to his left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser. Now that we've taken care of the introductions, we are ready to hear our third and final case for the January sitting, State versus John P. Kubica. Gary S. Cirilli of Rhineland will argue on behalf of Mr. Kubica.
Good afternoon. As you probably noticed, Mr. Kruger is not here today. We're from the Great White North. He operates a plowing business and was not able to make it today. His livelihood, of course, depends on snow, and everybody up there, at least every other person, has a snow plow in their truck, so any business he misses, the next person will get. So he asked me, first of all, to apologize that he could not make it, and secondly, he asked me to thank you for considering his case. As you know, we have filed a petition on behalf of Mr. Kruger, requesting your consideration on 2 separate issues. The first issue that I would address would be whether or not a circuit court judge should be granted the authority in his discretion to dismiss a criminal action with prejudice. The second issue is whether or not the failure of the state of Wisconsin through the Oneida County District Attorney's Office, failure to object to an order issued by Judge Robert E. Kinney, acts as a waiver against the state now appealing. As a brief restatement of the facts, Mr. Kruger is a 41-year-old individual who has lived in the city of Rhinelander his entire life. At the time of the alleged occurrence on July 16th of 1995, he had had no criminal record. Since that time, he has had no criminal involvement. In July 16th of 1995, police had received a report that Mr. Kruger was operating his motor vehicle in the city of Rhinelander while masturbating. The incident was investigated by the city of Rhinelander Police Department. Charges were filed against him. He appeared in front of Judge Robert E. Kinney, entered a not guilty plea, and requested a 12-person jury. The jury trial was scheduled for December 12th of 1995. On December 11th of 1995, the Oneida County Assistant District Attorney gave notice to the court and defense counsel that they had intended to use other acts evidence. Apparently, in February of 1995, approximately 5.5 to 6 months earlier, an individual had complained about Mr. Kruger operating his motor vehicle in front of their house in a suspicious manner. As I indicated earlier, Mr. Kruger operates a snowplow business, and he had some accounts on that road. The individual, in her statement to police, indicated that she believed she saw some pubic hair on Mr. Kruger. As you all know, and I'm sure you've seen from the brief and the attached testimony, a motion hearing was then held in January of 1996, on January 17th, in which testimony was taken from this individual, as well as law enforcement. After that hearing, Judge Kinney decided that, yes, the other act's evidence could be used, but on a condition. And that is why we're here today. After hearing the testimony and hearing Officer Shapey testify to the court that he had investigated, he had made 2 phone calls to Mr. Kruger. Mr. Kruger had returned 1 phone call. They had not made contact, and the case had died on the line. As Judge Kinney said, this case had died in the bowels of the Oneida County Sheriff's Department. Upon hearing that, upon hearing the testimony of Mrs. Shanick from what she believed she had seen, he felt it did fill the requirements for other acts evidence. However, he was very concerned about the inherent trustworthiness of the information. He told the district attorney at that time, Mr. Miklik, you may use this information. However, if you use it, you may not come back later and charge Mr. Krueger. I will not permit that. And I believe his exact order was on page 9 of the transcript. But I will tell you this, Mr. Krueger, that I mean, and Mr. Cirilli, that if the state goes to trial and is permitted to use this evidence, they are not going to be able to come back if they lose and charge Mr. Krueger with this offense of February of 1995.
Now, what, in your opinion, what did he base his opinion on? What law was he using that gave him the power at that point to make that bargain, so to speak?
Quite honestly, Judge, I don't believe this, he had any statutory authority or case law authority from the state of Wisconsin.
So he had basically what you're saying, inherent power, right?
Yes. I believe he felt from the facts that he heard surrounding this case, I believe he took into consideration the fact that Mr. Krueger, a 41-year-old individual who had lived in Rylander his entire life, had no criminal history, no involvement with law enforcement up until that point. He felt that it would be unfair to allow the state to use the other act's evidence when it had not been charged, when there was no intention for it to be charged, but now to allow the state to have a free kick at the cat, as he says.
But would it make any difference not to, you know, saying that it has anything to do with whether he's 41 or he lives in Rhinelander, but it's going to affect a lot of other cases where judges would, for whatever reason, hear its other acts, and perhaps there could be other reasons, use their inherent power to say you cannot prosecute this particular case. That's a concern, at least I think that I have, as far as what power are we giving to judges to make that decision, or for maybe other reasons, like the DA doesn't get his cases in time, and therefore I'm going to dismiss this, which he may very well for reasons after perhaps jeopardy, but at some point in time, doesn't this affect or could affect most criminal acts? The judge could use his or her inherent power to dismiss those?
It could, Judge, but I think this case is different in that for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think in this case, he didn't tell the prosecutor that he couldn't prosecute this case. What he told him was...
You have a choice.
Okay. He had a choice. And the state has argued in their brief that Judge Kinney has infringed on the realm of the prosecutor, the separation of powers, if you will. But really, I don't think he has done that. I think what he has said to the prosecutor is, there's a question of fundamental fairness here. Is it fair for Mr. Krueger to get on that stand, presuming that he will do that, testify about the underlying charges of which he is charged, and also testify about the other acts evidence, on the chance that his testimony can then be used against him? Is that fair to Mr. Krueger? Well, probably not. And is it fair to Mr. Krueger that these other acts had never been charged and had been sitting uncharged and uninvestigated for about 6 months?
Mr. Cirilli, let me, if I might interrupt for a couple minutes and go back to the line of questioning that Justice Wilcox was engaging in. You're justifying the dismissal order on the basis of the court's inherent power.
Correct.
Do you feel that that inherent power is based on the Wisconsin Constitution?
I do, Judge.
All right. Can you point to a particular provision of the Constitution that you think would justify the utilization of such inherent power?
Judge, in my opinion, I feel that the Due Process Clause of the Constitution should provide the court with that inherent authority. And the reason I say that is, and I think Judge Kinney is a good example of this, like yourselves, he is asked to make a decision every time he comes to court. He's in court virtually every day of his business life. He has to make decisions based not only on the law, but on the individuals in front of him and the facts in front of him. I think he has to take all those into consideration. And as you know from his decision, he said, what I question here is the fairness. This is due process, fundamental fairness. That's what I'm concerned about. Now, I agree with Your Honor that there is no law in existence at this time. The only law that is close is the Braunsdorf case, which was from 1980. But since that time, I think we will all agree there has been a burgeoning of case law and cases in the state of Wisconsin. The courts are overrun with cases. Our prisons, our jails are overrun with individuals. I don't think in 1980 the justices considered, and maybe they did, but the opinion doesn't speak of this, considered the way the criminal law was going to go, the amount of cases they're going to have to consider. And even in 1980, that case was decided on a 4-3 vote.
One of the things that I found interesting in reading during the noon hour, the dissent in Bronsdorf, was the fact that the dissenters seemed to believe that the source of the inherent power was Article 7, Section 2, which relates to the orderly administration of justice. Right. Do you think that's also relevant, or do you disagree with that?
No, I do agree with that, Judge. In fact, I believe some of the federal cases that I have cited refer to that particular concept. And they think that it's inherent, a judge should have the judicial discretion and inherent power to do this for the orderly administration of business and the respect of the judiciary. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, you finish.
Okay. I was just going to indicate that the respect of the judiciary, of course, is important to an individual who comes before it. I've been practicing about 12 years. I've done many jury trials, and at every trial, virtually every person who is charged says, am I going to get a fair trial? Now, part of that is because we live in Ryland, where we have two circuit judges. Even though the prosecutor is on the other side of the V, we all know each other. So they're very concerned about, you've heard the term, the good old boy club or all friends. They're concerned about that. And I think in a small town, the judges have to be more concerned and I think, take greater steps to make sure there is no appearance of impropriety. And I think Judge Keeney does that very well. You rarely see him out in public. He doesn't socialize a lot. And I think he's trying to protect the respect of his position. When someone comes in front of him, I think he's trying to assure them that they will have a fair and impartial trial. And I think in this case, that's what he was trying to do. Now, as you read his decision, I think you got the flavor of that's what he was trying to do. Now, I think he knew and maybe suspected at that time there was not precedence for this. But I think they should be able to do that. The circuit court judges should be allowed to use their experience, analyze the facts, take a look at the individuals in front of them, and make a determination on whether or not this is in the best interest of the law, best interest of the court. Now, I'm not asking...
By the judge...
I'm sorry, sir.
Judge Kinney, do you think he might have ruled the other way if there had been an objection raised? Was this almost a conditional thing? He was saying, look, I'll let this in so long as the district attorney doesn't charge. But if the district attorney is going to want to charge, then I'm not going to let this in. Was that at all at play here?
To pass your judgment.
Or you don't,
when I was there and I saw the judge's demeanor and the way he said it, it was my understanding that the prosecutor had the opportunity to charge. But he had to do so either before he used the other act's evidence, if he was going to use it, or not use it and do it after. And that's why I don't think Judge Kinney told him, no, you can't charge. And he didn't invade his prosecutorial authority. What he said was, if you charge this, you are not going to get two kicks at the cat. You can then not use the other act's evidence. And again, I think he was suspicious about it.
I guess the point that I'm making is, what if the judge had said that? That would clearly be improper, would it not? For the judge to say, I'm going to base my ruling on this motion to admit other acts evidence on the basis that you're not going to charge him. But if you're going to charge him, then I'm not going to allow this in. That would not have been a proper way. That would not have been an appropriate ruling, would it?
No, I agree, Judge. If that was his concern, he should not have let the other acts evidence in.
Yeah, either the other acts evidence goes in or it doesn't go in based upon the law, but not upon what the district attorney is going to do in the future.
And I think that that is probably true. However, in this case, I don't think that's what happened. I think he gave him the option.
So why does the state have to do anything?
Well, I think the state, like anyone else, I don't think they have any special position that they don't have to be concerned about objecting to certain orders of the court or protecting their arguments or issues before the court. I think the state has the same obligation as I would have when I come to court, and that is I must make sure of anything that goes into evidence is proper as far as the rules of evidence go. If I feel something is improper, I have an obligation and a duty to object. If I don't object, I can't raise that issue again. I'm precluded from doing that.
And that's indeed your second argument. Your first argument
Correct.
Is inherent authority. Your second argument is waiver.
Exactly.
A waiver, I always have problems with waiver because it's such an unclear line.
To be honest with you, Judge, I had the same problem when I was writing this. You could probably label it three or four different things. Is he a stop from doing it? Is it an election of remedies? It could be a number of things.
Well, make your best waiver, Arthur.
I personally feel that it is a waiver. And I think it's a waiver because he had a number of options that he could have explored well before the trial.
Who, the judge?
No, the district attorney, Your Honor. This motion hearing was held on January 17th of 1996. The jury trial was not scheduled until March 21st, and we didn't think it would go 2 days, but it did, and March 22nd of 1996. Up until that time, the district attorney could have filed the complaint and then tried to use the other act's evidence and objected at that time. He could have filed an appeal and asked the Court of Appeals to look at it on probably an interlocutory basis. He could have asked for a reconsideration with the court. He could have filed a formal objection to that order. He didn't do any of those. As a matter of fact, even on the day of trial, before he uses other acts evidence, he could have asked for a motion hearing in front of the court and asked for a reconsideration and put an objection on the docket, but he didn't. He didn't do any of those things. In my opinion, he waived it. He took the judge's order, accepted that, and did not voice an objection. And as I indicated earlier, I think that the DA should be held to the same standard as everyone else. He is a governmental agent. However, he is still responsible for that case. He is still responsible to voice an objection or take the appropriate steps that are necessary to ensure that that issue is not lost.
But why? Where is the duty? I mean, he might have been afraid, the district attorney might have been afraid, that if he did voice an objection, the judge wouldn't allow in the other act's evidence. Inappropriately, incorrectly, but that might have been his fear. Since it's a discretionary call, he probably wouldn't get reversed.
Judge, I agree. But if you're afraid and you don't do it, I don't think number one, BAPA would care for that. You're not representing your client zealously. In spite of any fears he may have had, I think he has to do it to create a proper record, much like I would have to or any other attorney. The fear that the judge may act some other way than he would, deem appropriate, I don't think that changes his position and his obligation. I do think he is required to object or that issue is waived. I don't think he has the option not to do it and then be able to bring it up later. Yes, sir.
Really, suppose at the motions hearing where the prosecution sought the admission of the other act's evidence, it had simply been admitted without any of the statements by Judge Keeney. And the same result happened. There was an acquittal and a second charge was brought. At that point, would the judge have been able to say, I'm not going to entertain this complaint, I'm dismissing this complaint because you had one kick at the cat already, and I'm offended by this?
To be honest with you, Judge, I think that if the discretion is allowed, he could do that. And again, it would have to be for the orderly administration of his court. I think,
and what would be the orderly administration? Not on due process grounds, or?
Well, I think due process as well. I think they're all tied together in this particular scenario. Obviously, right now, I don't think the law would allow him to dismiss this complaint on the basis that you had just spoken. But I think he should have the discretion to do that.
Mr. Cirilli, would that be unfettered discretion?
Well, Judge, it really isn't, because what happens if he makes a decision or any judge makes a decision that is not in the best interest or appropriate to someone who's in front of him? What do? They appeal. And ultimately, they'll end up here in front of you like I am right now. So it's not really unfettered because it's not unbridled discretion. It's discretion with a system of checks and balances. It goes through the appellate court, and it may ultimately end up in front of you.
So in other words, the appellate courts would look at it in terms of whether there was an erroneous exercise of that discretion.
Exactly, Judge. As you know, in civil law, this discretion has existed for quite some time.
Right, but what's the test?
Pardon me?
What's the test for erroneous exercise of discretion? Is it fairness?
Well, I think you'd have to look at a number of things. I think fairness is one. I think the due process, entire due process argument is another.
That's
one.
That's fairness,
I think,
too.
Right.
Due process is fairness. I mean, It's okay to say that you'll review the trial court judge, but what are we reviewing for? I mean, fairness in whose eyes? That's not very
But, Judge, I would assume it would be a similar standard as the civil court judges are reviewed.
Yeah, but there's a big difference between a civil case and a criminal case.
Right.
And we've got a long history in this state with civil cases, and it's not exercised very much. And a lot of times the discretion is exercised because of discovery procedures or failure to proceed. I mean, there are standards and there are techniques and there are statutes and there are rules that usually the violation of which mandate a dismissal. But I don't think you have the same kinds of things in a criminal case. That's the first point. My second point is you got a system in the criminal case with the executive branch. Now, I joined the dissent in the prior case, and I reread it, and I thought it was a good dissent. But now, I'm almost 20 years later. It's been the law of the state. Why should this court change the law of the state? We haven't had subsequent cases. It seems to be working out okay. Why should we change it? I mean, after all, one of the things about the common law court is precedent.
That's correct, Judge. But as you know, precedent has to start somewhere.
Sure. But and we have it for 20 years, so you have to tell me why it's not good enough.
Well, I think because of, number one, the number of cases that have happened, I think that...
Well, crime has increased, and what you're saying is we ought to let the defendant out at the front end. Let's just, instead of putting him in prison and letting him out when the prison's overcrowded, we just won't process him.
20 years ago, I don't believe the federal courts had this clause either. I don't believe the federal judges were allowed to...
If I remember the dissent, they cited federal cases as authorizing this.
Right, but I'm not sure that they had it 20 years ago. But at some point, the federal court didn't have it either. But they found it incumbent upon themselves to allow their judges to exercise this discretion. Now, is this the case that gives you the feeling that it should be granted at this point? I don't know.
I'll tell you what it gives me, and I have to scan the record. It gives me the feeling that maybe you shouldn't have admitted the other act's evidence. And it wasn't appropriate in the case.
And that may be true, Judge.
And so he compromised it.
And that may also be true. But I think he did so. Pardon me?
I said, do you get that feeling?
I don't. But again, I was there, and I think what he was trying to do was protect everything involved. He was trying to not cut off the prosecutor from doing his job. But he also wanted to make sure that Mr. Kruger got a fair trial. As you know, this type of charge is very sensitive. Having a second trial on charges, first of all, that would have never been brought up before. The deputy Shapey had said himself, this thing was done. He was done investigating it. So I think Judge Kinney saw this and said, well, now suddenly it's going to rear its ugly head simply because they have this guy in the string and they want to pour more on him. Now, should he have admitted the other act's evidence? Maybe not. But he did, and he gave the DA the opportunity to charge in the interim. So he didn't tell him, no, you can't charge. But he did use his discretion to try and protect the fairness of the situation, to try and protect Mr. Kruger, to try and allow the state to do what they had to do. But also, I think he did that because he felt that was the right thing.
If I remember Braunsdorf, even with that majority opinion, there was a kind of wiggle room in that opinion that would indicate that if there was misbehavior by the prosecutor, the trial court could dismiss.
And that's true. And as you know, Judge, it would have to be a Sixth Amendment violation for a speedy trial or prosecutorial misconduct.
Right.
And in this case, although it smells as far as the way it went down, I don't think it fits the elements of prosecutorial misconduct.
That was my point. Thank you.
And to waste your time arguing that, I won't do that.
Okay. Well, maybe that's where we should leave it, that you court can't dismiss unless there's prosecutorial misconduct.
Judge, I think you should consider, and I would ask you to consider, please, allowing your judges, the circuit court judges, some discretion. And the reason is they are in the best position to decide at that level what protects their court and what protects the individual in front of them. Unfortunately, you don't get to see a lot of individuals here because not many people have the money to go this far. It's a very expensive process for them. And I think that this probably would come up more often. Other cases would if it wasn't financially disabling to some of these people. I mean, Mr. Kruger is a good example. He's home plowing snow today so he can afford for me to be there, be here and argue this case for him. Now, I'm not using that as an excuse, but I do think that this would come up a lot more. Probably has, but because the last case that decided this was almost 20 years ago, I think a lot of attorneys will look at their client and say, well, that's the law, it hasn't changed in 20 years, they're not going to change it now. But does that mean it shouldn't be changed? Does it mean these judges shouldn't have the inherent authority to dismiss with prejudice?
If they didn't 20 years ago, why should they now?
Why should they now if they have it 20 years ago? That's a good question. And the caseload is not, of course, the only thing. It's a consideration. But I do think that the state court should follow the federal courts, and they should allow these circuit court judges authority to do that in their discretion with your review. It's not unbridled discretion. It's discretion with review. And I think that's the important concept here. I agree with all of you probably that to allow a circuit court judge the power to simply dismiss with prejudice all on his own and be the law to himself, that is not what our system needs. Yes, sir.
Really, as I read the Bronsdorf case, I was a little taken aback by the majority's search for some statutory authority for that dismissal. And it seems to me that reflected a concern about separation of powers. Could you speak to that and how that might have changed, if at all?
Well, I don't know if it's changed so much. We did cite, I believe it's 9-01-3-1A in our brief, and that, I think, touches on that issue somewhat. The separation of powers, of course, is the big problem here. And as the state indicated in their brief, they feel the court in this case is usurping the prosecutorial power, the power of the DA's office to function. They don't have unfettered discretion in charging people and prosecuting people, but they do have a wide range of discretion in who they charge and who they do not. I apologize, I do not have a case at my fingertip right now, but there's a state case that says that although the DA does have this discretion, the court should be in a position to oversee this somewhat. That is, use some of their abilities, some of their discretionary powers that they may have in existence to determine whether or not a charging decision is a right one. And I believe in the case I'm thinking of, it might have been Kenyon. The state had filed a criminal charge against an individual as a felony. After the court heard the evidence at the preliminary examination, they decided it was a misdemeanor and moved and charged it as a misdemeanor, reduced it to a misdemeanor on its own motion, sua sponte. Now, at that time, there was an appeal brought saying the court couldn't do that. But I believe in that decision, the appellate court said that even though there is a separation of powers, even though the DA has a charging decision, the court should have that power to do that, and they granted him the court the power in that case. I don't know if that answers your question, Your Honor, but I think there's already some of that power in existence, and I don't think allowing him to him, when I say Judge Kinney or any circuit court judge, the power to dismiss a criminal case with prejudice, I don't think that that will infringe upon the district attorney's charging decision or their ability to prosecute cases. I think it goes right in line with he should protect the judiciary and maintain its respect and maintain the administration of the business in front of him.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Tarver, your Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Tarver. I represent the state of Wisconsin. There is nothing fundamentally unfair about the state's prosecution of Mr. Kruger in this case, and that is why the trial court erred when it dismissed the state's complaint on due process grounds. It is also the position of the state that the assistant district attorney did not waive the right to file the complaint or object to its dismissal and was not estopped from filing the complaint. Finally, the state asks that this court decline to modify or overrule its holding in State v. Brownsburg, principally because there was no fundamental unfairness in this case. And it's the state's position that in order for the trial court to have had the lawful authority to dismiss the complaint in this case, there needed to have been a due process violation. There needed to have been waiver. There needed to have been estoppel. And if there was a due process violation, if there was waiver, if there was estoppel, then it makes no difference whether the court's dismissal was with prejudice or not. I believe Mr. Cirelli said in response to a question that were it not for the comments of the trial court in this case at the hearing on the motion to admit other acts evidence in the first action, that he concedes that the court was without authority under existing law to dismiss the state's complaint in the second prosecution. And I think that is correct. And the issue in this case really is whether there was anything about the court having said what it said that resulted in something fundamentally unfair and that would warrant dismissal of the state's complaint in the second prosecution. In the absence of that, the court didn't have the authority to dismiss, and it was error of the court to dismiss the complaint. The state considers that that issue comes down to this. The argument seems to have been that the court made these comments, the defendant testified concerning his February conduct in reliance on those comments, and now it would be unfair if the court did not get the benefit of this assurance or the comments that the court made that he would be immune from prosecution for the February conduct. The state disagrees that it would be unfair to deprive Mr. Krueger of the benefit, if you will, of the court's comments that he would be immune from prosecution under these events, because the fact that Mr. Krueger testified, if he in fact testified on the basis of those comments, has no detrimental effect on him at the time that the state commenced the prosecution for the February conduct. This is not a case in which the state's complaint is based on Mr. Krueger's under oath testimony regarding the February conduct. The state's complaint makes no reference at all to his testimony. The state's complaint is based on a police report apparently prepared at or about the time of the incident and based on the statements of eyewitnesses. And so, as of the time that Mr. Krueger brought this motion to dismiss, the fact that he did this thing, that he testified in the prior case about the February conduct, has no detrimental effect on him at all. The state is not relying on that in its prosecution of him.
Could I ask you, would the state be able to use his testimony against him if there were a second trial?
If Mr. Krueger shows that it would be fundamentally unfair for the state to use his testimony against him, then there should be appropriate limits placed on the state's use of his testimony at trial. But that hasn't been litigated yet because the trial court dismissed the complaint outright. And so we have no idea on the basis of the record in this case whether Mr. Krueger can show it would be fundamentally unfair of the state to use his testimony against him. For example, if the evidence is that he would have testified anyway, even without the court having said what it said, then there is nothing fundamentally unfair about the state using his testimony against him if the circumstances present themselves. So it is possible if the evidence shows that there's something fundamentally unfair about what happened here that he could get limits placed on the state's use of his testimony. But certainly it is clear that there was no prejudice to him, no detriment to him, as of the time that the state commenced the prosecution, since the complaint was in no way based on his testimony, and therefore nothing fundamentally unfair about the state having filed the complaint. No due process basis for dismissing the complaint.
Ms. Tarver, let me ask you, what would you think about this court expanding or extending Bronsdorf to cover the kind of situation you were just discussing? If there had been a violation of due process or a violation of fundamental fairness, if you will, which is really the essence of due process, why shouldn't, in that situation, a court have the authority to dismiss with prejudice?
Because in that situation, where the court is dismissing a complaint against a criminal defendant on the ground that the prosecution offends the defendant's due process rights, it makes no difference in the preclusive effect of that order, that that order is called a dismissal with prejudice as opposed to any outright dismissal. The cases, the Bronsdorf cases and the related cases, involve situations in which it would make a difference whether the court had the inherent authority to make its dismissal of a case with prejudice or not. For example, in the Bronsdorf case, the motion to dismiss was brought by the prosecutor with the express intent of reissuing the charges. In that case, it made all the difference in the world whether the trial court could make its dismissal with prejudice or not, because unless the trial court had the inherent authority to dismiss with prejudice, the prosecutor would be free to reissue the charges.
Given what happened in Bronsdorf, don't you think it was a hollow sanction for the court to dismiss without prejudice? I mean, how meaningful was that?
I agree. I don't disagree at all. In fact, that's my point. It makes a huge difference in a case like State v. Bronsdorf whether the court has the inherent authority to dismiss with prejudice or not. In the absence of the inherent authority to dismiss with prejudice, the state can reissue. But that's not the case under the circumstances of this case.
But if you allow Bronsdorf to stand, what control does a trial court have for the kind of situation that was set forth in Bronsdorf? What sanction is there for the action that had been taken there?
It seems to me that in the State v. Bronsdorf case, if there is prosecutorial misconduct of some kind, or if there is a due process violation, if there is a ground like that upon which to dismiss the complaint, then it seems to me, just as would be the case in this case, the dismissal has the kind of preclusive effect you're talking about. The state, and for example, in this case, if there is a decision by this court that it was a due process violation of the state to prosecute Mr. Krueger, the state is in no position to reissue the complaint. The doctrine of issue preclusion prevents the state from trying to get a different judge to reach a different decision about the due process issue.
Well, then why shouldn't we extend Bronsdorf to cover due process violations, to say that if there's been a violation of fundamental fairness, the trial judge has the inherent power to dismiss with prejudice?
Because I do not disagree that trial judges have the power to dismiss when there has been a due process violation. My only point is that it in no way enhances the power of the court to have the power to make that dismissal with prejudice. It it doesn't further the administration of justice, because to dismiss, period, when the dismissal is on due process grounds, is to dismiss with the same preclusive effect as a dismissal with prejudice in the Brownsdorf type situation.
Why shouldn't we clearly say that then? If that's really the effect, why shouldn't we just clearly say that?
Well, I think this court certainly could recognize that there is a distinction in Brownsdorf-like situations and other situations, and an outright dismissal in a case where the state's prosecution does violate the defendant's due process rights, unlike here. I think this court could acknowledge that under the issue of the doctrine of issue preclusion, the trial court, the district attorney is not free to go back into court and try to get a different trial judge and try to get a different decision on the due process question. The district attorney can't relitigate the due process issue. And so the district attorney can't reissue. And that is true even with a simple dismissal that is not necessarily dubbed a dismissal with prejudice.
Now, in saying that, I understand you're not conceding that there was a due process violation here.
That's correct. The state does not concede that there was a due process violation here, and in fact is fairly adamant that there was not. Not in the filing of the complaint.
Well, let's move on to the next issue.
Next issue.
Why doesn't the state have a duty to object under these circumstances when it knows, or should know, that the judge is operating under an erroneous impression of the law? Because obviously he was, at least under Brownsdorf, he did not have the right to do what he said he would do. We've got a lot of law that says that we've got to bring these things to the attention of the judge so that the judge can make a decision based upon the correct law. But your district attorney stood silent.
Right. I have two things to say about waiver. First, I think it is important to point out, when you step back and you look at the waiver question, that this is not your run-of-the-mill waiver case. The run-of-the-mill waiver case is where someone who is under there's a rule that says if you've got an objection with how the trial court is proceeding on an issue, tell the trial court before you go to a court of appeals and ask that court to say that what the trial court did was wrong. So you very often see that the waiver rule is applied where someone who was in front of the trial court was silent, raised no objection as to an issue, and then for the first time raises an objection on appeal. And the appellate courts say silence is waiver. And the reason silence is waiver in those circumstances is that there is a clear obligation to raise the objection in the trial court. Silence when one is obligated to object is waiver. And so in that situation, a silence is waiver. Here, it's the state's position that the district attorney's silence was not waiver because he was not obligated to object. And he was not obligated to object because of the nature and the timing of the comments themselves.
Well, I look at this. I'm the district attorney, and Judge Kinney is making his ruling. Now, as the district attorney, I know that the judge is wrong. You know, when the judge is saying, hey, okay, I'm going to let this evidence in, but you can't bring this case again, and I sit back there and I know the law. I know the existence of Brownsdorf. And I know the judge is wrong and that the judge doesn't have the power that he thinks he has. Isn't there an obligation to tell the judge that at that time?
No, because the judge is talking about, he's expressing his intent to handle a situation a certain way if certain events occur, events that haven't happened and may never happen. He's expressing his intent to handle an issue in a certain way if an action is filed over which the judge has jurisdiction that hasn't been filed and over which the court has no jurisdiction at the time he's making these remarks. just as the court's remarks were premature, if you will, it would be premature to impose on the district attorney an obligation to respond to them. It's, to me, this is a lot like if you assume for the moment that the court excluded the other X evidence, but in doing so said to the defendant, I think, Mr. Krueger, you're a very bad actor. And if you are charged in the future on the basis of these other acts and you are convicted, I intend to impose the absolute maximum sentence allowed by law. Now, is the defendant in that situation obligated to object or otherwise be deemed to have waived his right to take up the question of whether he should be sentenced to the maximum allowed by law if all these things ever do happen? I think it would be an extreme use of the waiver rule to impose waiver in a circumstance like this, basically because of the nature of the comments themselves and the fact that the court was talking about something that had not happened and might very well never come about.
But the state asked that this evidence be admitted, right? The state asked for this. Now, and the state argues for the motion that it makes to admit evidence. And the judge says, okay, I'll admit it, but here's the deal, in effect. And the prosecutor knows that that deal is not good. And you think the prosecutor has no obligation to the court to advise the court that the basis upon which evidence is being admitted is fallacious?
I think, as I believe Justice Bablich suggested earlier, it is not entirely clear from the record that the court was basing the decision to admit the evidence on these comments. And it would be, you would need to draw an inference from the record in order to arrive at that conclusion, and I'm not sure that that is a reasonable inference on the basis.
And why did he say this? I mean, if that's not the inference, give me another inference. A reasonable inference.
Another reasonable inference? I've just given the state something that will now benefit the state. How about if I turn around and give you something, Mr. Krueger, that I hope will benefit you too?
Does the judge get that authority to do it?
He's without authority to do it. My sense is that there's no dispute about that. The court had no authority to say what it said. The court was in error. But it was not something that the district attorney was obligated to object to at that time or to have waived his right to file a complaint later on. Well, if there are no other questions of me, then I think I will sit down.
Ms. Tarver, before you get to do that, tell me why you think there's should be a distinction between the court's inherent authority to dismiss with prejudice on the civil side and the court's lack of such authority on the criminal side.
Well, the one obvious difference that was emphasized in State v. Brownsdorf is that, at least it was the perception of the majority, the civil cases affect at least primarily the litigants to the cases, but the disposition of criminal cases affects the public at large. There is the interest of the public at large in the enforcement of its criminal laws, and that is the distinction.
Do you think it's a separation of powers issue also?
There may be a separation of powers issue. There may be some sharing of powers with regard to the initiation of criminal prosecutions and so forth. But again, it seems to the state that in this case, the fundamental question is, was there a due process violation? Was there waiver? Was there some reason that the state should not be permitted to prosecute Mr. Krueger. If there was, then the court has all the authority, all the power that it needs in order to dismiss, and to dismiss with final preclusive effect for the purposes of this prosecution. Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cirilli, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Counsel has indicated that the new complaint was filed strictly on the reports of citizens that they had received and had not relied on the testimony of Mr. Krueger. Well, I don't think any of us sitting here can say that that's going to be absolutely true, that there will be no prejudice or detrimental effect to Mr. Krueger now that this case has been filed against him. First of all, you can never put Mr. Krueger back where he was before that testimony occurred. Even if the testimony, as it was given at that motion hearing, is not used as an exhibit, the prosecutor will always know what was said. Mr. Krueger's defense, the way he answers the questions, the facts, the way he testifies concerning all the facts surrounding his case, that can never be changed. He can't be placed back where he was. I think it is impossible as a practical matter. He will also always suffer some prejudice and some detriment because of that motion hearing and the testimony that came in. It is impossible to assume that this new charge can be handled in a vacuum without knowledge or use of the information that either the prosecutor or the sheriff's department or someone has received concerning that case. That cannot happen.
Are you making an argument of jeopardy?
No, I'm not, Judge. But I'm just responding to counsel where she said he has not been prejudiced and there's no detriment. And I think as a practical effect, that's not true. She also indicated in the Braunsdorf decision that the facts in that case, of course, were different. In that case, the court was concerned about an on-again, off-again prosecution, if you may remember. And that's why they responded the way they did. In this case, the facts are certainly different. This is not an on-again, off-again prosecution. But an on-again, off-again prosecution, that is one where the district attorney or the prosecutor is allowed to dismiss a case and then bring it back later because it's dismissed without prejudice. It's true. It may not have any testimony yet. Jeopardy may not attach, but the individual going through it is suffering some burden with this. It's financial. It's exposure. It's a loss of credibility in the community. And again, I'm from a small community, so it probably affects us more. But those are very serious considerations, considerations that should be considered when determining whether or not this case should be on and be off again. And that's why I think giving the court the opportunity and the power to dismiss with prejudice in a criminal forum is very important. One of the justices asked if there's a distinction between civil and criminal, and counsel indicated, well, civil really only affects just the litigants. I don't necessarily believe that to be true. As you know, there are a lot of cases involving insurance companies, and when an insurance company is infected in a case, everyone suffers because the costs to all of us are increased. Healthcare cases are the same way. We all will suffer the burden of cases either being dismissed or lost or prosecuted all the way through on both the civil side and the criminal side. To say that the criminal side is unique in that fashion, I don't think is an accurate statement. I think the judges should be allowed the opportunity and the power to dismiss with prejudice in both, because I think there's a trickle-down theory to maybe every individual in the community and in our state. Yes, Judge?
Could I ask you, I understood you to say that both incidents occurred either in or very near the city of Rhineland.
Correct.
What if incident number one had occurred in Vilas County rather than in Oneida County? Do all of your arguments still hold true?
Well, I think it does, Judge, because Judge Kinney did make the decision he did because it happened in the city of Rhineland. I think he looked at the facts, looked at the individual involved, and looked at the law that surrounded him at this time. Whether this would have happened in Vilas County or not, I don't think would have mattered, simply because the case that he was dealing with was an Oneida County case. These facts, whether it was in Vilas County or Iron County or Dane County, I don't think would have mattered because the testimony would have been the same from both the Sheriff's Department and the complaining witness, and I think that's what he based his decision on. I don't think it was a localized decision.
What I'm trying to say is this. Would you have permitted the judge to bar, in Oneida County, to bar a prosecution of the first incident in Vilas County without participation of the Vilas County District Attorney or any Vilas County judge?
Judge, I'll be honest, I don't think I understand the question.
Both incidents were in Oneida County, and they involved the same personnel, the same judge, the same prosecutor. Suppose the first incident had been in a different county, so that the prosecution of that would have been a different district attorney, and there would have been a different judge in a different county. Would you, in effect, authorize the Oneida County judge to bar prosecution in a different county, even though the officials in that county have had no role in it?
Under his authority, and if it's granted, I think that that would follow through, because I think, as you know, circuit judges are on the same level, and they do not and are not in the position to act as appellate judges of other sitting circuit court judges. I think, again, the appellate court would have to rely on the impression of the circuit judge at the time that these facts are looked at. He would have to use his discretion, of course, subject to review. But yes, I do think it would bar another county, if that's your question, Your Honor. I think it would. I think it would have to. Just like any decision now in any county, I think, carries over to the other circuit judges. And partly because of what counsel said, it prevents judge shopping, for one thing. Certain judges, as we all get to know, have certain areas of the law that they either favor or disfavor. And if we were allowed to judge shop, it would be easy to pick a judge that would be more inclined to give you a favorable decision on a certain area of the law. Likewise, I think if you allow one judge to oversee another judge on the same level, I think that that is a bad scenario. So yes, I do think that that would apply. The last thing I would indicate is counsel was asked that if the state has the duty or the obligation to object. In the case of Mackman versus State, clearly says that unobjected errors are waived and cannot be reviewed for the first time on the record. And they use as a basis of that ruling the case of State versus Boschka. And that case says that they want to discourage the allowance of continuing error in the hope of obtaining a new trial if they lose. That is exactly the situation we have here if the district attorney knew that Judge Kinney was in error and didn't do anything to correct that error. Because then, if that is true, he could have used the knowledge of that error, kept it, gone through the trial process, he did lose, and now go forward with the next one and appeal that error, which is what we're here today on. And I think that's what that case stands for. Now, none of us can look into his heart or his mind and determine whether or not he knew that. But by the same token, you cannot look into Mr. Kruger's mind, and Judge Kinney recognized that, and make a determination on whether or not he relied on the judge's promise. We would submit he did because we prepared for trial. However, Judge Kinney recognized that the, I believe it was July motion hearing, that he said to put Mr. Kruger or Officer Shapey on the stand at this point would be self-serving. Certainly they're going to testify to benefit their case.
Thank you,
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. We are adjourned until our February sitting.
We do have January 15th.